Hi, I'm Deb Crowe, and welcome to season two of the Heart-Centered Leadership Podcast. This is the podcast where we connect, learn, and laugh together with strong leaders from all over the globe. Here, you will learn from peers you haven't even met yet. You will gain new tools to add to your leadership toolbox. Because whether you're a C-suite executive or a first-time entrepreneur, we all contend with challenges, and there's always room for improvement if we choose to seek it. So please, pull up a chair and listen in. This is the Heart-Centered Leadership Podcast. Welcome back to Imperfect, the Heart-Centered Leadership Podcast. I'm just coming off laughing because I've been having a joyous conversation. My guest today is across the Atlantic Ocean in beautiful England. Let me tell you a little bit about Maurice Evelyn Bufton. He has over 20 years experience in investment banking and financial markets. He's also an advisor and helps with executive search. He is the owner and managing director of Armstrong Wolf, and he set up his company in 2011 and has subsequently established his firm as a market-leading voice within the COO, CCO, CAO, Chief of Staff, and business management spaces. So if you work with a C-suite leader or you are a C-suite leader, I want you to pull up a chair because you're going to enjoy this conversation. So Maurice, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Deb. Delighted to be here.
You know, we were chatting before we hit record, and I got to say, I love Google because I wanted to find a resource for my C-suite leaders, and this is how our paths crossed. And with technology, here we are having a chat. So I'm always in awe when I type in exactly what I'm looking for, and there you were.
It's a wonderful resource, isn't it? If we went back 25 years ago, actually went back to the day I was born, it would be Star Trek stuff, really, wouldn't it? But now it's reality. It's day-to-day activity.
Absolutely. When I was doing my research on you to prepare for our interview, I really wasn't surprised to find so many lovely comments about you. And I'd like to read one from one of your colleagues. And you were described so beautifully in this recommendation. He said, Maurice has an ability to address difficult and challenging aspects of any relationship, offering well-informed and well-positioned advice. He's a rare breed in today's modern banking that he sees you and your business from a personal perspective and not merely as a commodity or a statistic or as part of an annual target. Beautiful. So my first question is, share with the listeners when you felt that you really developed this heart-centered leadership quality in your role as a C-suite leader.
Well, I think it's quite a long journey. I think there's many parts of the jigsaw that make up who I am today. And some of them sound as if they may be cliche, but I think certainly the influence of my parents, which had a very value-based approach to life, always telling us to do the right thing, even if the right thing wasn't the easiest thing to do. But I think the pivotal point in relation to my own personal development was actually the day I passed off the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. Yes, it's a academy and a college which is dedicated to leadership. But I think it's more than that, because what that did for me, it created a sense of purpose. And in fact, much of what I learned at Sandhurst, I've carried forward to what we do today, because much of what we do today is focused around the COO's role in influencing conduct, culture, and behavior. And when you look at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, one of the principles they teach you is that the overriding influence on a person's behavior and a soldier's behavior is the person that leads them, and that you should never actually forget that responsibility. I also remember when I passed off from Sandhurst, my father, grandfather, and great grandfather were in the army as well. I turned to my father and said, Dad, so what makes a good officer? And he said, it's very easy, son. You just have to remember they salute the rank and they fight for the man. And that was a point in the direction of that you had to have a degree of personal courage, You had to have a degree of empathy in relation to leading your soldiers. And I think the other thing that you learned in the military is that a lot of people think the military is pyramidal, top down. You say jump and your soldiers say, how high, sir? It is absolutely the reverse of that. It's a consensual approach where ultimately someone has to make the decision, but you need an empathetic approach and the art of listening to make sure that you can make the right informed decision. So I think that it gave me a purpose. It gave me personal courage and confidence in myself but a balance in that. And I think it was really further refined in my last 7 months of military service, where I was privileged to lead my soldiers in a United Nations tour in Bosnia, where you actually put into practice everything that you were taught. And it really was a privilege to have yourself tested, but also understand that that your obligation was to your soldiers, it wasn't their obligation to you. It was your obligation to lead them. And actually, when you're leading with soldiers on average 18, 19 years old, I was mid-20s at that age, it was a significant learning curve, but it was a privilege to be given that learning curve. So I think that's the foundation stone of what I would say of my journey. And I would say the other thing is that the foundation stone is recognizing and being open to the mistakes on your journey in life, yeah, of which I've made many. An ability to stand up and accept those, and also apologize on occasion. I think they're all they're cliches, but cliches have been proven to be cliches because they've been being proven right over time. I don't know whether that answers your question, Deb, but
you did. There's so many nuggets. I got to pull a couple of things out of there. I love how you talked about the conduct, the culture, and the behavior. I love how you frame that, but what I take from that and what I really, really heard is when you look at everything in the journey, all the transferable skills that you bring, especially from the military, that structure and the discipline of behavior is so predominant in leadership, and it was part of your journey. And I love that you talk about your successes, your wins, your failures. I think being a heart-centered leader is three of the things you mentioned: empathetic, being an attentive listener, but it's okay to fail forward, because when you get up and lead and teach the lesson, that's the win-win in failing. So many good things there, but you led beautifully into my next question, and we did not rehearse this. See what happens here, Morris? So the second question has been around since the start of the podcast, last March, 2020. What imperfections do you bring to your heart-centered leadership?
What are my imperfections, or what imperfections do I bring? I think I have some would say that it is a weakness, but I have a deep-rooted faith in human spirit to do the right thing, which means on occasion, as a leader, I have been taken advantage of, and on occasion, more than one occasion, I have probably been found responsible or targeted to have the responsibility for other people's failings. I think that I wear my heart on my sleeve. And I think that people may perceive that as a weakness and something to be taken advantage of. I have probably on many occasions thought myself, whether should I change who I am on my belief in human spirit to give people opportunity, you know, to give people the opportunity to rise above themselves. But I've kept fast at that. I've said, no, I'm not going to change. And it's been quite painful on occasion. You know, as I said, I've got some things wrong in many ways, the sort of how I've grown the business, how I potentially look back, how I could have made different decisions in relation to managerial decisions and leadership decisions. But what I've tried to do is keep the personal moral code of how I operate as a leader, and not to actually, from skiing terms, go off piste from that journey. So I would say that I've created a great degree of potential vulnerability by my steadfast belief in human spirit and forgiveness.
Well, you're going to get kudos from me because that is the epitome and the definition and qualities of a heart-centered leader. And like you said and alluded to in question one, it's been part of your journey. And I think when we lead with heart, there's going to be valleys, there's going to be bumps and barriers, but when you lead with heart, your head and your heart are aligned. And to me, I think that's such a high level of empathetic leadership. It doesn't come easy to a lot of people. So I'm going to say, Morris, keep leading with heart. My third question is, give us a little glimpse into the journey of your two books. The first one was No Place to Hide, and the second one was To Catch a Thief. I'm excited to get both. And why you chose to have a philanthropy slant, because I know you give the proceeds, they're given to three different charities. So give us a little glimpse into how these stories evolved and why you chose to give the proceeds to the charities.
Well, the charity is the third book, which I that I need to bring into the conversation. But let's start on the first two. So I think the first one, which is the No Place to Hide, The Evolution of the Role of the CEO. It's a pretty narrow reading audience. When I printed it, it was probably the CEO of my mother, God bless her. But I think that's relevant to what was the journey of me to be looking at COO, which also directly links to the journey to the second book about the control officer, who principally focused on conduct and behavior. So Q4 2007, I was running a search business, Trafalgar Partnership, about 80% of our income was reliant on two banks, Lehman Brothers and RBS. And in Q1 2008, we're all pretty aware of what happened then about the credit crunch. And the over-reliability of the business on those two banks crucified the business ultimately. Now, at the same time, my father had actually gone into hospital. And he'd actually been given they gave him the wrong injection, which instigated a stroke, which he died 6 months later because of that. And he wasn't an investment bank; he was a retail banker. Yeah, he was a very decent man. And I remember on his deathbed, this was Q2 2008. He was noting that at least I know I've left mum in good order financially. I didn't have the heart to tell him that he spent 39 years at Barclays and he'd lost 80% of his life's work and value because of the credit crunch. Now, ultimately, what happened was that the business had to be closed, and then I had to take stock on what does this actually mean for me personally and professionally. Now, this is the link between what then took me to the COO and conduct, because one of the things I started to look at was how did this all happen? What were the origins of the credit crunch? And to me, it came down to, I think there was a lot of understandable anger and understandable, probably misinformation at the time, because actually I think overwhelmingly, apart from a very small bunch of individuals where there was malicious intent, I think it actually came down to poor judgment by a lot of individuals and ill-informed judgment as opposed to intent. So I then started to look at, well, who is responsible now to try and to correct this wrong? And it sort of fell into the office of the COO because there wasn't who else should be doing it. And it's at the center of the organization. Now, prior to that, I'd been doing executive search and focused on sort of middle office and product control. A lot of those had actually, some of those have migrated into the office of the COO. So they were my sort of, they were my carry forward. And I thought, well, now I'm going to nail my colors to the mast and that's all I'm going to do. So I had the parallel run between looking at the COO because they are responsible for conduct and actually then looking at the evolution of conduct itself. I then wrote a first article, which was Defining the Indefinable, the Evolution of the Chief Control Officer, another exhilarating read. And I invited 25 COOs for dinner to discuss it. 29 turned up. And that was the springboard of my business in relation to, I started writing an article every quarter on the role of the COO. I went out for dinner with he's a wonderful chap, John Weiser, XEY, and he'd read one of my articles and he just said, what about this book you're going to do then? I said, what book, John? He said, well, you can't just have them floating around. Why don't you put them all together in a book? That's how the first book happened. Now, at the same time, and ironically, the first article became the first article of my second book, not my first book. So I think there was an opportunist journey that led me to, I think I was, like everyone, I'm a frustrated writer. Going from being a frustrated writer who's writing articles and distributing them to a known audience to go into print is quite an emotional journey, because you have to have a degree of humility. Because I'd say, oh my God, yes, I'm pretty good at English. And then you actually have someone proofreading it, you go, maybe not quite as good as I thought. But then I thought, well, actually, I didn't want to, combination, I thought no one's going to buy the book. But then the combination of that, I thought, well, I don't see any, I don't want to make any financial gain out of this. So what can we do is actually, I'd like to incentivize people to read it, but also by incentivize people to actually be sense of giving at the same time. And that was in relation to, well, specifically two charities. One is Sight Savers, and the other is the charity I set up in Bosnia in memory of the four soldiers that we lost when I was on service in 1994-95, and that's the Grassley Children's Foundation. And the Sight Savers really goes back to, in 1994, my regiment had actually was celebrating its 300th anniversary, its tercentenary. I came up with an idea. I was going to run a marathon on each of the continents on Earth to raise enough money to give sight back to 300 children, which I did the first six. But then we were deployed to Bosnia and I had to do a marathon on Christmas Day, which I'll come on to in a minute. And that was why Sight Savers. And why Sight Savers is that I think if given the choice, I think that sight is the overwhelming gift from God that actually did you is sacred. Yeah, I think to actually be able to see a sunrise, a sunset, to see your child's face, I'm a spring man as opposed to winter, autumn, or summer. To see the first signs of spring, I think there are so many wonders that sight gives you that that's why I was focused on it. If you can give sight back to a child, because it was all children, then that's no greater gift can you give. So that was Sight Savers, and that was the first and the second book. I don't know whether you want me to say what the leap is into the third book, because so I've got these two books that they were like bookends. The CEO book came out first, my next book came out second, my Bosnia book, and then the third book, my book on conduct and controls, came out third. So the second book really is, I think to me, is at the heart of who I am and what I do. So I set up a charity in 2012. Myself and 17 of my ex-colleagues, comrades, went back to Gorazda in Bosnia. So we were in a place called Gorazda, which is one of the Muslim pockets which the British Army was sent to protect. You may have heard of, say, Zebanica. It was in line with one of these things. But we went in to protect the Muslim population. The town pre-civil war or Bosnian war was about 20,000 people. By the time we got there, a UN exclusion zone around the town, there were 65,000 Muslims gathered into the town. And then we had to impose a peace on the warring factions, because the Serbs were at the point of actually invading the town, and we lost four of our soldiers in the first 3 or 4 weeks there. But in 2012, we went back to relay the memorial stones, and we took with us one of the soldiers was Andrew Grant. Now he'd been involved in one of the incidents where three of his comrades had been unfortunately or very sadly and tragically killed. He had an epiphany at that moment. And 17 years later, he came back as a priest to relay the memorial stones to the soldiers at the exact spot where he'd had the epiphany and also he'd lost three of his comrades. And that afternoon, we were taken into the school. We didn't know it was going to happen. 17 old, slightly overweight ex-warriors. And then watched the school, about 130 children, sang in Serbo-Croat. They basically were singing, roughly translated, they were thanking the British Army for saving their parents and grandparents. On a moment of an unplanned moment, I said to the headmistress, I said, what can we do to help? You know, we came here to salute the past. What can we do for the future? She said, we'd like to teach our children English. And I said, well, I'll do that. And also, I turned your bit of a cliche. I said, I turned your playground into a field of dreams, because they couldn't play football because it was still there's shell marks from the war. And you wake up next morning and you think there's certain promises in life you cannot forgo on. So I then set about setting the charity up. Incidentally, Andrew Grant, who's one of my the ex-private soldier who became a priest, 6 months after he came back, he married my wife and I, and he's christened all three of our boys as well. So there's a continuity then. I served with him. He was a private soldier. I was privileged to be a captain at the time. And now he's our family vicar. But then with the book, I saw an opportunity to leverage the goodwill of the global COO community. So I started talking about this. Well, at the end of these dinners I do, I said, I just want to take 5 minutes of your time. And I talked about what I was doing. And in no short order, I'd raised £75,000 from the global COO community. They paid for the production of the book, and then we paid for the rebuilding of the school through the book. And the book's called Donkey Mel and Bully Beef, The Art of Surviving. And it's called that because when we went into Gorazda, the Serbs put an embargo around, so there's no food and no diesel allowed in. So we had to buy the donkeys to distribute rations into the mountains. And the rations were dried rations, bully beef. But more specifically, the only thing the Serbs allowed in was royal mail. So God bless Queen Elizabeth. Anything with her head on it was allowed in every 8 weeks. So we distributed the post that way. So that's why it's called Donkey Mel and Bully Beef. And we raised £75,000. We've rebuilt the school. We've actually had a school extension for the English, teaching English. And every year now, there's an essay written by the under 9-year-olds of less than 500 words, or not more than 500 words. I dreamt of a faraway place. My boys' school headmaster and head of English, we then redo the essays. We appoint a winner, girl and boy, and we fly them, plus also their English teacher, to the UK, and they spend a week in our boys' school. And then they take back to them those memories. But I think more importantly, or equally, they also take back the living memory of the reason we did it, which is actually to remember the four that died, the four young lives that we left, you know, in the valleys of the former Yugoslavia. So what I've managed to do, because I'm fortunate enough to run my own business, I've managed to marry my own personal vocational journey and charitable cause. And there's so many marvelous charities in the world, and but this is my personal one. This is my personal journey. And somewhere, is to use a cliche, somewhere in a foreign field, there lies an English boy. And there's four of them in Gorazda. So I've managed to marry my personal vocational driver with the goodwill and the harmony of the COO community through the production of my three books. And it serves my purpose, pretending that I'm a writer. One day in about 50 years, someone might pick up this book. Who's this Maurice Evelyn Bufton?
Well, and it's a heart-centered leadership journey. And I love how you pause to look at how it all came together. And it's so beautiful. And really, it's crafting not only your leadership journey, your personal journey with heart, it's what you just said. It's your legacy. It's absolutely beautiful. So heartfelt. My last leadership question, it's a loaded one, but I want you to just tell me what's sitting on top of mind. What do you think is the number one frustration globally right now for COOs?
The number one frustration for the COOs, I actually think the number one frustration for the COOs is being their platform given the resources for them to be as effective as possible. Because I think a lot of COOs spend their time firefighting and putting out fires as opposed to the real value added aspects that they feel that they could add value. I mean, if you look from the pandemic perspective, I mean, that was a comprehensive failure of the imagination by everyone. It wasn't as if the pandemic was an unforeseen event in history. It wasn't as if we had the alarm bells with SARS in the at the early of the century. But actually, the the COOs, I think, feel as if they were able to pivot their energies forward, horizon scanning, emerging risk, if they were able to actually spend more time on human capital aspects, then use their platform, their centralized platform, for better purpose, because it has visibility. A COO generally has visibility over everything, high influence over almost everything, own everything, and it doesn't have to. And I think there's a degree of frustration in relation to the underutilization of the platform, which comes to under-resourcing. The other frustration that comes through that they, in certainly financial services and in banking, in the cyclical nature relation to scaling up, scaling down headcount, the COO's office can become a soft target for headcount reduction, because it's like, well, what do they do? And I always say that the COO is a bit like you're in a relationship and you decide to finish the relationship, and you don't understand the value and everything that you enjoyed about that relationship until you've lost it. So I think the biggest frustration is you've got an untapped intellectual capacity and a willingness to get things done and a capability to get things done, which simply is being restricted by not limited faith in it, but actually possibly a limited understanding of the power of the platform and the willingness to give the investment to them to do their job correctly.
Well, that was brilliantly said. And I was so interested to hear your answer to this, because I am coaching COOs currently in 5 different countries. And I loved your term. They are firefighting. And it's interesting that, you piggybacked it with the second frustration. And they do have high visibility. They do have high influence, but there's so much energy management put into that firefighting that they never get to the grassroots of what they really want to do. So I loved hearing how you framed that. And I'm wanting all COOs to know that we hear you. Okay, finish this sentence for me, Morris. Heart-centered leadership is?
The ability to lead yourself, to be honest with yourself. And if you're honest with yourself and you're transparent in being so, then a high percentage of people follow you with good intent.
Absolutely. Beautifully said. Third question. Is there another book inside your heart that you're going to write?
There is indeed. There is indeed. Now, this is really going off piece. Well, I want to write something for my boys, and I've got an idea. There's a dormouse called Marmion, who's the keeper of peace. The lord of the land is a badger called Bergwell, and the lord of the sky is a barn owl called Gerwain. The only animal that can speak to Mother Nature is the hare called Caradoc. And it's an environmental book actually showing the trials and tribulations on nature through the eyes of the animal kingdom. The dormouse is effectively going to be the druid, the keeper of time and myths. And I had to find an animal that hibernated, not many hibernate in the UK, because Mother Nature had to spend the time of hibernation to download legend, myth, and history. So the dormouse on the first day of spring could actually then tell all the animals about their origins to this point of day. So now I've got 3 books out of the way, and I think I've proved I can write. I now want to write something I really want to write, which I don't know how many COOs will read a book about a dormouse called Marmion, but you never know. It might surprise us.
Well, and you've said something that a lot of my guests have said. They never thought they'd write a first book, and then they wrote a second book, and then they wrote a third book, and then it's like, now I'm going to write something that I want to write about. So what a nice legacy it'll be for your boys. And it sounds intriguing. And you'll probably take it to a limitless level. So we'll have to stay tuned for that one. My last question for you, Morris, is leave us with a quote or a memory that has permanent residence in your heart.
Well, one of the quotes is what my father said when I was at Sandhurst. Which was, so remember, son, that they salute the rank and they fight for the man. The other is, it's a very simple quote, was my mother passed away last year. And on her gravestone, she always used to say this: whatever you do, just remember life is for living. And It was, to a degree, a carpe diem approach to life, but that's, you know, she lived that. She lived that to the very day that she passed away. Every moment is precious. So life is for living. That's what I say.
Well, that's beautiful. And I'm so grateful that I found you through Google. I am in awe of the work that you're doing. I love your COO magazine. I thank you for creating it. My clients are loving it. I love sharing it with them. And I look forward to putting this amazing podcast interview out to the globe so everybody can find out about you. And I'm truly grateful for your time and expertise.
Well, thank you, Google, and thank you, Deb, for, you know, for choosing me, giving me the opportunity. So I look forward to speaking to you again, hopefully.
Absolutely. And we will share all of Morris's contact details and links to his book below in the podcast episode description. And I hope you take away from today a little bit from Morris's journey and that leading with heart is truly the only way.
You've been listening to the Heart-Centered Leadership Podcast. I'm Deb Crowe. If you like what you heard today, please rate and review the show. And I'd love it if you'd visit my website at debcrowe.com, where you can sign up for my newsletter and get access to the Heart-Centered Leadership Toolkit, all free of charge. Thanks for your time, and we'll see you again.